inviting me to participate in this program and for giving me the opportunity to give a talk, which will be on integrability, correlation functions, and particular limits of those. And this is work done with Jorge Escobedo, Kalia Agramov, and Amit. And it will be slightly, it won't be on scattering amplitudes, it will be on a slightly more general class of objects, which are correlation functions. So let me start with a very simple motivation, which of course I would not need to do it for this program, but let's recall that normally we have heard many talks on scattering amplitudes, where we have an amplitude, and here we can have, typically we say it's gluons, but we will be doing n equals 4, so we can have any field here. We can have some complex scalar, say, with some momenta, some other complex scalar with some other momenta. So this is some on-shell guy. And this z and x, they are some complex scalars of n equals 4. Say this other notation that people use is, say, phi 1, 2. So in terms of the etas, is the component, you pick component 1, component 2. And in terms of the real scalars of the Lagrangian, it could be something like phi 1 plus I phi 2. OK? And we will use these scalars z and x. X is another one. We will use them a lot throughout the talk. So one of the main things that we learn in integrability is that it's always useful, or it's often useful, to generalize as much as possible to try to find some structure, and then at the end of the day simplify back to the problem that we want to study. So that's what we want to do. We want to generalize, to complicate our life a bit, in the hope that at the end we will come back and simplify and have gained something by doing this. One of the main goals of using integrability, for example, is establishing a language which is the same both at weak and at strong coupling. And this, often you need to take some limit where the operators will be large and so on. So we need to consider a more general class of objects so that we have a unified language both at weak and at strong coupling, so that we can try to use the power of integrability, and then we can come back to simpler objects. So here, I will not be focusing on correlation functions, but we will consider something more general, you know, which are correlation functions. So I'll draw roughly the same picture, but now I have some operators. These are some local operators, O, at some position x. So these are local gauge invariant operators. Okay? And we have some correlation function, say, again, with six local gauge invariant operators. And these local gauge invariant operators in n equals 4, in the planar limit, in the large n limit, they are single trace operators, so trace of some number of fields. So here are a couple of examples. Say, if you have your scalar z and x, it could be something like this, a trace with two z's and two x's, or two z's and two x's. Here is another linear combination. I'll come back to this point in 1 minute. Here is another one, a smaller one. This is the famous Konishi operator, just phi I, phi I. So we have some single trace local operators, and we compute this kind of correlation functions. And of course, if you know correlation functions, you can come back to amplitudes through the LSC, or through somehow some fancier ways of doing that we know now. For example, we know that if we pick these points and put them light-like separated, this correlation function, when you put these 6 points to be like separated, what happens is that you generate a Wilson loop with a shape of this dashed line. So this object becomes this famous Suzy loops that we heard a lot about. And these Suzy loops are, of course, related in a nice way to this scattering amplitude, as we heard a couple of talks already. And of course, we have also the usual way of going from correlation functions to scattering amplitudes by doing LSC. These gauge invariant operators, they depend on the position in space-time. So what happens here is that you put here some operator. Actually, it's not, I think, if I understand correctly, it's not really some operator. It should be, for example, one that works is, say, this O3. I don't know if I see Greg Korshemsky in the audience. No? Ah, yeah. So for example, this O3, which has two fields, it's a nice one. So what you do is you put that separated by This distance here will be the moment that you want to, of the amplitude that you want to study. And you put here O3, and you can even put O3 plus the, all the super, the Konishi multiplet. And then when you expand in ETAs this object, you are basically getting the amplitudes. Right? Amplitude square, okay. I did not put equal signs, I put arrows, so it's okay. So there is a close connection between the integrand in some cases, the full loop, the amplitude. There are many interesting objects. And of course this object is interesting, it's more general, it's more of shell, it's more rich than correlation than scattering amplitudes. It contains scattering amplitudes at a particular case. It contains quantum gravity in flat space, as Joe was saying yesterday. We analytically continue, we find some extra singularities of this guy, and we understand the flat space limit of ADS-CFT. We can take OPEs of these extra operators and see what is flowing between them, and we have information about the spectrum. So it's an extremely rich object which we want to study. Okay, very good. So then what do we put for these small operators to start playing? So the most obvious candidate is to pick something small like this, like Konishi, or even simpler. Like there are other fields which are like Konishi but protected. Let's do O4, which would be trace of phi I, phi j, which would be symmetric traceless. So these guys don't even get anomalous dimension. So you could think, let's pick four of these guys and start studying this object. Okay? And this was computed by some people to one loop, to two loops, at three level. And the results are nice. But this is not what we are going to do. We are going to complicate one more time in the following sense. We want to consider OI to be more general operators. We don't want to take the simplest. We want to take operators which can have, for example, a large number of fields. And the idea is inspired, of course, by integrability for the spectrum problem, where this was extremely fruitful. The idea that instead of trying to study directly the small operators, which eventually at the end of the day are the ones that we are most interested in, they are the simplest ones, it's very important to enlarge, consider big operators, understand everything about them, and then worry about reducing their size at the end. Okay? So don't pay attention to this huge formula. I just want to flash it at some point. So of course now, if I'm telling you that I want to complicate, we have to answer why complicate. And so let me recall you briefly why it was efficient, why it was very useful to complicate in the case of the spectrum problem. So let's make a small detour. This is not the main subject of the talk, but I want to make a small detour. So what is the spectrum problem? The spectrum problem is related to computing two-point functions. Not four-point functions, but two-point functions. So you have, say, the operator there, O1 of x, O1 of 0. Let me see. Do I want O1? No, I want O2. O2 of x, O2 at 0, for example, it's given by 1 over x to the power 8. That's it. So this is what it is for any lambda. So the anomalous dimension of this operator O1 is just equal to 4. O1 is a BPS operator. It's a protected operator. O2. The anomalous dimension of operator 2 is 4. OK? So it's a classy, it's a BPS operator. OK? You probably are all familiar with the operator trace of z to the 4, or z to the L, which is just a BMN string, which is a protected operator. This one, you just act with a rotation, which converts some z's into x's, and it's just related by rotation to the BMN string. So it's again a BPS operator with rotated R charge. Then you consider, say, O1 of x with O1 of 0. Say this would be Konishi. This operator here is called, it's in the Konishi multiplets, like phi I, phi I, by the way. And what you get is 1 over x 8 plus 6 lambda over pi square plus dot dot dot. And this means just that the dimension of the operator 1 is 4 plus 3 lambda over pi square plus dot dot dot. Okay? So, and say O1 with O2 would be 0. Okay? And any linear combinations you can play. So, solving the spectrum problem means finding this. So how do we find this? How do we find this dot, dot, dot? So at the end of the day, what we want, say, is a plot. We want to find delta 1 of lambda. What is it as function of lambda? OK? OK, good. So first thing, so this can be done in perturbation theory. So we can just start doing Feynman diagrams, renormalizing the operator, and seeing at one loop it gets correction, at two loops it gets more correction, at three loops, and so on. And at strong coupling, also, this operator is dual to a small quantum string. We could also start computing quantum corrections, classical, one loop, and so on. Now, if we would have done it, we would not have succeeded in solving this problem, because we would not have seen the power of integrability, which allows us to solve it for any coupling. So the way we do it for the spectrum is then, so as a first step, we complicate. That is, instead of the operator trace zx squared, we consider a more general family of operators. Naively, it looks much more complicated. We consider many of these scalars z, then we can have the x field, then many z's again. Then we even don't choose only the scalar. We put other scalars. We even put fermions. We consider this huge mess. OK, naively, this looks like a disaster. Why would I start studying these huge operators? Now, the dilatation operator which is the operator such that whose eigenvalues give me the anomalous dimension, which I can compute in perturbation theory, the mixing matrix, acts on these single traces to give me more single traces. So if I think of this guy, which has a one-dimensional structure as a spin chain, then this dilatation operator, by definition, is the Hamiltonian of this spin chain. And because I consider this limit, where this length is very large, the energy, the anomalous dimension, will be just a sum of the individual energies of these excitations if I give them some Fourier momenta, p and k, etc. So it will be just a sum of epsilon of pj. OK? Just because this chain is large, and therefore the energy will be the sum of the energies of the individual excitations. Is this clear for everyone? OK, very good. So what would be, more precisely, if this is operator O, what would be operator O? Say, operator O would be something like this. Let's write a precise operator O, at least at one loop. So as we said, we give some momenta to this guy. So what does it mean? It just means that we Fourier transform, of course. So we sum over n1 smaller than n2. And then we say that particle 1 has momenta n1, particle 2 has momenta n2. And we put here trace of z, z, a next field, say, at position n1, z, z, a next field at position n2, and then this. For example, this looks OK, except that these guys, so this one has momenta p1, this one has momenta p2, they can scatter and exchange their momenta, right? In two dimensions, it's the only thing that can happen. They can only exchange the momenta, nothing else. Therefore, there should also be another plane wave where the momenta are exchanged. And what is the relative coefficient? That's the definition of what is an S matrix. OK? Good. So this is the kind. I'm labeling these boxes because I'm going to use them at some point, but I think that I won't have time to go through everything if I did not do this in this way. So OK, so we have now these operators which have this form, where we have some plane waves, some excitations, and then these excitations scatter with each other. So why does this help us? Because now we use integrability and symmetry. Okay. So this was the work of, I'm not telling this story in a chronological order, but rather in the simplest, I hope, possible way conceptually. So this symmetry, fixing, now using symmetry and integrability, was mostly the work of Niklas. And what he said was that, OK, so we know that the energy is the sum of the individual energies of this momenta, of these particles. And these particles, they are quantized. The momenta are quantized because simply the system is finite. All right, we have a finite trace, so it's a finite circle. What we need to study to quantize this momenta is the way the particle scatters. So this is the key object, this S. Okay? And now what happens is that the S, this S matrix, this two-dimensional S matrix, is fixed by symmetry. That is, if you impose that the symmetries commute with the S matrix, there is a unique solution. Okay? Up to an overall factor, which is fixed by crossing, but let's ignore this. So you know, so it's fixed at any lambda. Let me add a subscript lambda to indicate it's fixed at any coupling. And now you quantize the momenta. We quantize the momenta Pj. How do we do it? Okay, so we have our single trace operator. We pick one of these particles in the trace, say the fermion or whatever. We pick it, and we carry it around the trace. And when we carry this particle around the trace, the wave function should be periodic. The total phase should be 1. So this particle scatters with other particles in the spin chain. They can be X's or fermions again, or whatever. And at the end, this total phase must be 1. So let me write an equation. I think it will be clear. We have that the moment of this particle times the length, the number of operators in the single trace, times the interactions whenever it meets any of the other particles, the phase shift acquired when this particle meets the other ones, is equal to 1. Okay? Now, this looks very innocent and very simple, but of course here we are already using integrability. Because we are saying that we pick a particle, we carry it around, and the particle scatters with the other ones in a factorized way, in a pairwise way, just a sequence of scattering of pairwise events. So we just the scattering of P throughout all the other n minus 1 particles is just a sequence of two-body scatterings. Okay? So if you want, this is an hypothesis of integrability, which turns out to be true. Okay? So equivalently, these equations, let me add another box that I also want to keep. I want to write this equation saying that the phase is 2 pi n. Okay, let me write this in the following way. This is equal to e to the 2 pi nj. This is the definition of the function nj of all the momenta. Okay? And I want to keep this definition here. I think at some point I will have to erase stuff, but okay. Let's see for how long I can last. Okay. Good. So again, so what we do is we solve these periodicity conditions, which are called the Bittan-Zatz equation. We plug this quantized momenta Pj into delta, into the energy, which is the sum of epsilon of Pj. Okay? And this is done, and we get the spectrum at any lambda for large L. That's the point. So why do we need large L? So first, it's nice that we get it for large lambda, for all lambda, but we need somehow large L in a way that can be made precise, which anyway, I will not try to make it in this talk. But we need to take it large because we are dealing with S matrices. So we are saying that the particles are walking, then they scatter, then they walk again, then they scatter, but then they need space to behave like free. Okay, and now at the end of the day, we want to go back. We said that we were going to complicate, but we wanted to go back. We want to study the dimension of this operator. Okay? This operator, so Konishi, has n equal to 2 magnons, and j minus n equal 2. Okay? By the way, for future, let me define this quantity as being j2, this one as being j1. So it's a small operator, so j is 4. So then we use another trick in integrability, which is cute, which is, okay, we have our finite space. Now, this is 4. And we are doing the path integral, say. We have lots of time, which we are not using. So this is a huge time unused. So what do we do in the path integral? We say, okay, then let's look from this direction. Now we have a huge space and a finite time. So then, looking in this direction, we get a huge space. So the S matrix approach is valid. And we get a finite time, which just means finite temperature. That's not an issue. That's not a problem. So OK, we have just to compute a partition function at temperature 1 over 4. And we can compute in this way the spectrum, the anomalous dimension of Konishi, and we can finally plot it. OK? So this was the message. It's very important to complicate and then to simplify. In particular, you see that in this picture of integrability, you have this chain, you have this single trace, and the particles propagate, and so on. What happens from the string theory point of view? Exactly the same. You have your string, then you have some bumps on the string. They move, they propagate, they scatter in the string, and so on. And I could have said everything I said, replacing the word spin chain by string, spin excitation by world sheet excitation, and so on, and everything would go through. It's an absolutely unified language which treats string and gauge theory in exactly the same way, and which is therefore a useful way for studying weak, strong coupling, any coupling you want. Now, we do not have yet a unified language for studying scattering amplitudes. So, I mean, we believe that, for example, the OPE that Amit described and Juan described a bit, we see structure. We see some structure of the OPE at weak coupling. We see some structure at strong coupling. But it's not solid enough so that we can be able to say that this is the unified formalism that treats both. We clearly see that it applies both at weak and at strong coupling. But it's not something as clean as what I've seen so far. Now, in correlation functions, we claim that for certain correlation functions, we manage to find this common language, this language where we understand the, in a very similar language, weak and strong coupling. So let me go back to the problem that I started, where we want to study correlation functions. OK? Now, these correlation functions, as we know, in a conformal field theory, can be written as a sum of three-point interactions. Then we sum over the spectrum, we sum over what falls, and then we have another three-point interactions. So this guy, this structure constant, C1, 2, 3, are, if you want, the main building blocks of correlation functions. And if we know them, in principle, we can put them together to construct any correlation function. So this is the fundamental building block. So this is the object we will focus on, three-point functions, the structure constant, which are three-point functions. I should say that, I mean, we can say, I mean, described as I did, it looks like the spectrum problem is a very simple problem, and that we have anomalous dimensions at any coupling, and that's more or less a triviality. It's not true. The final form of the equations that we now have for this delta of lambda to be able to plot and so on, they are still very complicated. And this is one of the nice things from a pragmatic point of view that I think that this problem will teach us. This problem will ask us, this problem will not care about the anomalous dimension of an operator with length 5 and 3 excitations. But this problem will tell us, I want to know this particular sum of anomalous dimensions. It will ask us very precise questions to the spectrum. I want to know this sum rule of anomalous dimension, and not just random spectrum lines of the spectrum. So I think this will be a very important question generating machine for make further progress even in the spectrum problem. Okay. So this is what we want to study. So three-point functions. Okay, so the first thing we want to understand is, okay, so we have C1, 2, 3. This is a function of what? What is the data that enters here? Okay? So okay, so this is the correlation function. This is related to the correlation function of three operators, right? O1, O2, O3 is equal to C1, 2, 3 over some factors which are just fixed by conformal symmetry. Okay? So we want to study this C1, 2, 3. Okay? Now, O1, what is O1? O1 is some operator like, I think I numbered it already, like 7, like we wrote there before, right? Some operator like this one, okay? Now this one, I can graphically, represent this operator as saying that I have here nothing happens, and here the two particles scatter. Now, in general, I will have some operator like that one, but with more particles, say with three particles. Okay? So, with, if we have n magnets, we have n factorial terms. Right? For example, if you have three, you can have just a plane wave, p1 n1, p2 n2, p3 n3. Then particle 1 can scatter with particle 2, particle 2 can scatter with 3, particle 1 can scatter with the other 2. And you would have these three diagrams. So each diagram is just a plane wave multiplied by the appropriate two-point S matrix. This will be three factorial terms. Okay? O2 would be some other R factorial terms. And O3 would be some Q factorial terms. Okay? So we have these wave functions. Okay, very good. Now, these terms, they are parametrized by what? They are parametrized by what, these states? They are parametrized by the moment of these excitations, say here, P1 and P2. In general, P1 up to Pn for this guy, P1 up to Pr for this guy, P1 up to Pq for this guy. So each of them will have its own momenta. Okay, so now we know the data that these guys depend on. So C1, 2, 3 is a function of the Tuft coupling, of course. Then it's a function of the momenta of operator 1. So let's see, this parameterizes the excitations of operator 1. In that case, we just have P1 and P2. And P1 and P2 are quantized through these equations. Then we have the momenta of operator 2. Let's call it Kj. And then we have momenta of operator 3, say Qj. Okay? So this is the object we are after. It's a function of lots of variables and of lambda. Much more complicated than the spectrum, of course, which is just a function of, if you want, lambda and p, and the set of momenta. Any question? Everyone agrees that this is the data, right? The three-point functions depend on the three operators, which are parameterized by the momenta of these excitations on this pinching and lambda. Now, if you see that, okay, you don't see because I didn't tell you what the S matrix is. Okay, no, it doesn't matter, actually. Take the momenta to 0, p equal to 0. The wave function becomes constant. And you just get the operator, they become delocalized, the excitation, which means that you put x's wherever you want. You just put it symmetrically everywhere. But then you are just acting with a symmetry generator. You're just acting with the operator, which creates an x from a z, if you put it everywhere. And then you act again. So if you take the momenta to 0, say p, if you send them to 0, O1 goes to a O1 BPS operator, a protected operator. Okay? So we have this function, and we know that this function approaches the function studied by Minwala, Seiberg, and others in the case when, so this approaches the case BPS, the case with three BPS operators, when I send p all the momenta to 0 of the three operators. Okay? So it's a good check that we have to do. At the end of the day, if we set them to 0, we must get the correlation function between three BPS operators, which is known in the literature and which is fixed. And it's just a number. It doesn't depend on the coupling. Okay? What do we think, what do we consider in the general case? We consider the case where we have, again, n of these guys, r of these guys, and q of these guys, and they are all 0. So just three BPS operators. And then we start waking them up, which means we start deviating away from the protected case and we study the general one. For example, we can set these guys to 0, these guys to 0, and this one not to 0. This means one is not BPS, the other two are BPS. Or we can wake up everyone and no one is BPS. Okay, very good. Any question? I did half an hour. Okay, very good. I think I am on time. Okay, any question here? No? Good. So what is the simplest then setup then that we can consider? So we have this structure constant, which depends on three operators. And we'll consider the case depicted in this figure here. So operator O1 will be made of a linear combination of operators which contain just x's and z's. something like this. Operator 2 would be made of roughly the complex conjugate of O1, contains only Z bars and X bars. And operator 3 contains X bars and Zs. It's one choice. So for this guy, I think of the Zs as being the vacuum and Xs as being the excitations that move. For this guy, I think of the Zs as being the vacuum and X bar as being the excitations. And for this one, I think of the Z bars as being the vacuum and X bar as being the excitations. And then, this is a kind of diagram that you have to compute at leading order at weak coupling. So if you want to compute this object here, okay, it starts at leading order plus lambda one loop plus tac tac tac, and let's consider this object here at leading order. Let's start by the leading order. Then this is what you have to do. You have an operator here, and you just need to weak contract. Oh man, but then you say, okay, so much introduction for such a trivial computation. Why isn't this just a completely obvious computation? It is not, because what do you have here? Here you have the wave function of the operator 1. This is like, I can think, as I said, as a spin chain. And you have here a sum over these n factorial terms. So you have lots of terms. Here you have, again, a sum over all these possible wave functions. Here, again, a sum over all possible wave functions. And you have to solve this combinatorial problem. Okay, weak contract, and whenever you can weak contract, and you compute the overlap of this wave function. Okay, so this is, of course, a purely combinatorial problem. Okay, it's trivial to enunciate. I just have these wave functions, I sum these states, and I sum over all possible ways of doing these weak contractions. Okay? What kind of techniques are used in solving this combinatorial problem? Why can we solve it? Could we always solve it without integrability? No. It would be, roughly impossible. I mean, for each number of excitations, we would have to diagonalize in a computer the dilatation operator. It would be basically hopeless to try to find any kind of general structure. So why does integrability help us? Because what we have to do is the following. We have our operator 1 here. This is our operator O1. And what we have to do, we have this wave function, we know the wave function. And then what we have to do is break the wave function. We split the state and we get two entangled halves. So we have operator O1 and we break it into, say, a left and the right part. We do the same for this operator here, for the operator O2. So there is a procedure here of cutting. Let me try to draw a scissor. We cut these states, and then we contract half of each state, so we get this. We get these six open chains after we cut. So there is first a procedure of cutting. So to solve this problem, we have to understand how do we cut these quantum states. So technically, it means writing the state as a tensor product of two halves and a sum of these. So it's just getting an entangled state of two halves. And then the second step is gluing. How do we glue this piece with this piece? So this part is gluing. In other words, in a technical language, we have a wave function and we compute the overlap, the scalar product between two different wave functions. Okay? So technically, this gluing involves scalar product of beta wave functions. Okay, and this is a sophisticated problem in the study of integrable models, computing scalar product of beta wave functions. There are books on it. They are called scalar products of beta wave functions, roughly. And they compute scalar products of beta wave functions. Okay? And the results are written as sums of determinants of this momenta and so on. So let me give you an example of what kind of thing it looks like. So why isn't this trivial? You might think a scalar product of two wave functions, it's one if they are the same eigenvalue, zero otherwise. So why is it not exactly the same? Because this guy here, the full guy, was a non-shell state. It had some momenta, some magnets, which are here, some excitations that are here, and some that are here. Once you break, these excitations, they are quantized with respect to the big operator. They are quantized with respect to the original operator. But once you break, you get some excitations which are not on shell with respect to the new length. So we are overlapping off shell states. We have some wave functions which are not eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So they still have this form. They are wave functions, still have this form. Because if you break the chain here, I mean, how could the chain know what happens over there? So they locally, they have the same form. But the momenta P1 and P2 are not quantized with respect to the length of the chain that you cut. So they are off-shell beta states. They are off-shell beta states. So, for example, consider the case where the last momenta goes to zero. So O3 is BPS. Okay? So we have this one here is BPS. Okay? This one is parameterized by some momenta P, this one by some momenta K. Further, it's very convenient to introduce the following variables, UI, which are 1/2 of cotangent of PI over 2, and VI, which are the same for the other momenta. Okay, so it's just convenient parameterization of the momenta. Then, O3, BPS, you solve this combinatorial problem and you get this huge monster. So this is the kind of thing that you get. So C123, the solution to this combinatorial problem, what does it involve? It involves just things like this, sums over partitions, ways of partitioning the Vs, which are this case, into two groups, group one and group two. So you have a huge number of terms in this sum. Then you have things like this, F alpha alpha bar. This is shorthand notation for a product between momenta in partition alpha, momenta in partition alpha bar, interacting in some simple way. Then, inside this big sum, you have an A times a C. And there are some Bs outside. The Bs are determinants of derivatives with respect to beta roots of this N. This N is in this box. Okay? You have to compute this kind of determinants. So probably people from matrix models know how to simplify these things. Then what is A, which is inside the sum? A is another sum over partitions with, again, some interaction. This is roughly like a determinant. This we can still take care of. And then there is the monster, this C. This C is a sum, a double sum over four partitions, such that alpha with alpha bar is U, beta with beta bar is V. And inside the partition, inside the argument, there are determinants, which involve interactions between partition alpha and beta and between alpha bar and beta bar. And this one, we have no clue how to simplify. Okay. So what do we do? Suppose we say, okay, this is the final result. For now, let me assume this is the final result. Later, I will reduce this to a couple of letters. It will become extremely simple, but let's suppose this will be the final result. Okay? So what do we do? Exactly the same as before. I don't know if I still have it written. No, I have not. So how do we do now to compute three-point functions of operators? The same. First, we solve the beta and that equation, the periodicity, and we find the momenta of operator 1, Pj. This is parameterizes one operator. Then, again, we solve the beta and that equation, and we find the momenta Kj of operator O2. Okay? And then we plug in monster. And we get a number. We plug and we get a number, like 0.85 or whatever. Okay? And this is the structure constant. Okay, so before giving an idea of what kind of numbers we get, let's speculate a bit. What kind of ingredients enter this formula, which is just a solution to a combinatorial problem at tree level? What kind of ingredients enter here? Let's look, for example, at this N. What's the ingredient? What is this N made of? It's made of S matrices. Okay? But S matrices, Nicholas told us what the S matrix is at any lambda. So why don't we try to do some inspired guess and promote these quantities with the experience that we have from the spectrum and try to see, can we somehow guess what would be the generalization of this formula to all loops? Simply, when we see, say, the S matrix, we replace by the S matrix at all loops and so on. Okay, this might work. I believe it captures part of the result. So what happens when you go to loops? Two things happen. The wave functions are modified. Okay? Notice that the overlap of wave functions is, if you want, the hard part. It's a very non-local part. You have some Hamiltonian, you have to diagonalize to find this wave function, and then overlap this big wave function here and here, this non-local part. And this is what we solved at tree level. Now, at loop level, we know how to correct wave function. We could still compute this overlap. And then there are new contributions, which are like, start putting loops here. These ones are not just correcting the wave function, but they are, in a sense, easier, because they are very local. They interact between spin I and spin I plus 1. We don't expect them to be determinants of Hessians, of sum over partition, and so on. We expect them to be something local. So we expect that there will be a simple all-loop generalization of this, which takes care of the overlaps, times something simple, which will be local, and which will be taken into account by these local interactions that we start putting in the worksheet. OK. But this, let me end the speculation and continue with what we hope is solid science. And let's, to make progress, we are going to take a classical limit. Okay? So this is the third part of the title of the talk. So we are going to take a limit where these operators, so 1 and 2, are very large, and where they can be approximated by classical states. OK, in this formula, we can do it. We can put here whatever we want. We can just put in the continuum limit and solve. The question is, can we, for example, analytically simplify this expression where we put many, many particles? And the answer is no. Technically, we can't do it yet. So we have to find some other tool. And this is what we will do. The punchline of this, why we are very excited about it and why we like this very much, is that by taking this limit, we match to compare and to get a precise match with strong coupling. So this will allow us to have an exact match and the same language at weak and at strong coupling. Although so far I only spoke about weak coupling. So what is the classical limit of a spin chain? A classical limit, or one classical limit, is the limit where you take the length of the spin chain to be very big. Do I still have the definition of J1 and J2? No. So let me remind you. So J1 was the number of Z fields, J2 was the number of X fields. So J1 goes to infinity. J2 goes to infinity. J1 over J2 is fixed. OK? Many particles. Now, this is not enough. This is, for example, when you have antiferromagnetic state of a spin chain. It's a thermodynamic limit. It's not classical. It's very quantum. To do it classical, we take low wavelengths. So the picture that we want is we have, so let me think of this X as a spin downs, this Z as a spin ups. Then we want to think of our spin chain as a spin chain, which is slowly, the spins are slowly changing. This would be what is a classical limit, where you can approximate your spins by some fields, U, that changes slowly as you go in the spin chain. Right? This is what we want, a slowly changing configuration. So we want to take long wavelength, so we want to take momenta to be like 1 over L. This means, for example, that the energy, okay, will be the sum of momenta square. You sum up to the number of X fields, which is J2, so it's of order 1 over L. So 1 over L square, but you sum L terms, 1 over L. So what is this? What's the physics of this? So these are low-lying excitations around the ferromagnetic vacuum. So you start with all spins up, and you do some low-lying excitations around the ferromagnetic vacuum. And this is known what happens in this limit. In this limit, the spin chain becomes a field theory for this slowly changing field, which is the Landau-Lifshitz field theory. OK? Now, since we computed this monster, let's use it, because, and then let's be smarter and use the Landau-Lifshitz. But first, let's still use this monster. So when you take these limits, where do the beta roots typically go? Where are the solutions to these beta equations? So I will use these variables u, which is 1/2 of cotangent fp. And I will draw what this is. So in the plane U, so this is U, which is 1 half cotangent of P over 2. Actually, I want to plot U over L, because you see, if momentum scale like 1 over L, this is of order 1 now. Okay? So what happens is that the solutions to beat equations, they organize themselves into some smooth curves. Like in matrix models, you have eigenvalues of matrices, they go to some smooth curves. Here it's the same. You solve beat equations, and they go to some smooth distributions like this. So here is one, and here would be, say, another cut. This is what is called, are called cuts. Do I still have beat equations? No. So beat equations were of the form e to the 2 pi I n equal to the momenta times the product of S matrix. Okay? So if you choose n, some many particles, you choose the same number n. Then they all go to the same support. So this would be all particles with n equal 1, for example. And this would be all particles with n equal minus 1. Okay? So all the solutions of beat equations. This would be something like this. So this is a typical solution. Okay? So let's do the following. Let's plug this solution, let's solve this numerically, and let's plug it into the monster and get a number. Okay? So what we do is we fix J1 over J2, we increase J2, and we plot C123, or to normalize it, we plot C123 over the protected result as we increase J2. Okay? So again, we could do J2. You see, you think that we want classical limit. How many could we put in the classical limit? I mean, you can guess that, you see, if you see all these sums over partitions, this is very factorial. So we could put 14. So the biggest we could go was up to 14. 14 roots. This is the classical limit there. 7 roots on each side. Looks like classical. It's more or less what I drew. Okay, I drew probably 16. But we could do 14. 14 took 40 hours. We just evaluating this. The solution is trivial. To get a solution to this is trivial. Then you just ask the computer, compute this sum. And there are so many turns, it takes 40 hours. Okay. In a computer for that Z uses probably half an hour. But still, sorry?
5 minutes.
This was a 4-core that Colly was very excited. He had a new computer in his office. That's cool. So you plot and you get some points. And they seem to be converging to a constant. You fit. So we do a fit. We say, let's ask a constant plus 1 over j and so on. And we get a prediction for this, which is 0.856889. OK, very good. This is data. This is our experiment. And now we want to reproduce this data from this physical Landau-Lifshitz picture. OK? So what is the picture? The picture is that our state, the idea is to approximate our state, which is a sum over n factorial, very entangled terms. It's probably the most entangled possible that you can imagine. You just sum, where is it? Just sum all terms like this, super entangled, by a state which is not entangled at all. It is just U1 tensor U2 tensor U length of the spin chain, where this U1 is U component 1 times, say, X plus component 2 times Z. Just. And this is just a unit vector that changes slowly, as indicated here. You just put configuration that changes slowly. Okay? So in particular, U with U, it's normalized so that this is 1. Okay, cool. So what does it mean that I can do this? How do I say I can do this? Well, this I can do if, when computing averages of classical operators, I get the same result. This is when I can use coherent states. So this means that the exact state with some classical operator and then an exact state, this would be the beta state, the exact one, I can replace by coherent states if I get the same thing for a classical operator up to corrections, finite size corrections. Okay? This is some classical operator. Like energy, spin, and whatever. Okay? And the conclusion of thinking about, say, the Hamiltonian or the path integral derivation of the spin chains is that if this vector U is a Landau-Lifshitz vector, if it's a solution to the Landau-Lifshitz equations, then indeed there is a map between solutions of Bittan-Zatz in the limit where you put many, many particles, which condense into these curves, and solution to the Landau-Lifshitz field theory equation of motion, and you can indeed approximate it by a field. For example, that solution, which is the two-cut solution, will be given by a folded, let's call it string, which is clear, by a folded string solution, which is a solution with two modes excited. So the picture from the point of view of field theory is the following. You have these cuts with some mode number. This mode number was the integer that solves Witt equations. And now you have this guy that has two modes excited, two big cuts. Now what's the analogy? The number of cuts is the number of modes of the field theory that you turned on. The size of the cuts is the amplitude of the modes, like the action variable. The mode number of the cuts is the mode number, the Fourier mode number. So this is the analogy. So there is a one-to-one map, number of cuts, number of modes, size of cuts, amplitude of modes, mode number of cuts, mode number of the string. So that guy would be the dual to a folded string. And folded string, Arkady studied in very extensively, and this is how the folded string for this looks like. I just represented the first component. It's not very complicated. So for a given ratio, J1 over J1 plus J2, that we keep fixed, we find a parameter Q. These are elliptic integrals, elliptic E and elliptic K in Mathematica. Then this is the solution. U1 is Q, some Jacobi sign, elliptic function, and so on. This is what it is. This is the analog. This is a strongly coupled field theory. It is not just Fourier modes, but OK, this is the analog of two modes. OK, very good. So this would be the two-cut solution. Now, how do we compute the three-point function associated to this four-cut solution? And here comes the huge advantage of using these coherent states. When you use these coherent states, which are not entangled at all, let me insist, this is the big advantage, the overlap is trivial. You just have here U1 contract with operator 2, which we take to be U2 bar, U1 bar. U2 contracts with U2 bar. And there is no sum. This is just really a coherent state. Then these weak contractions are all trivial. So now we take the classical limit only now. We say that O1 is roughly equal, and I will come back if I have time to this point, to O2 bar. And this guy is small compared to the other two, which are taken to be large. Then this ought to work, because then what this guy is like an operator inserted in these big classical states. Actually, this picture of thinking of one of the guys of the three-point function as an operator was first pointed out by Radu and Anastasia in a paper some years ago. So you have this classical, this is the point, now it's classical, and then a small one, so you can replace these big ones by coherent states and compute this. All these guys, since they are normalized, this stuff here is roughly one, because this one with this one is one, and so on. So all you have to do is you go here and you read these components. These guys, I said, are x-bar fields. So here you read components 2, some number of terms, say J2 terms. And here you read component 1 of the field, J2 times. And you sum over where you put this small operator. OK? So the result of this computation is that the three-point function, this formula will be absolutely clear when I will write it, is just, from this point of view of coherent states, this three-point function is just some number, and then there is an integral over where you put d sigma over 2 pi. Okay, so d sigma is just this index k. And then we have component 2 of this vector, which depends on sigma, to the power j2, component 1 of this vector to the power j1. Plug this guy, compute this integral, and we get 0.856897. And this is almost perfect. We had 14 roots only, so then we got like 4 digits right. Okay, very good. So we trust that these coherent states work. It should be possible. We have this huge animal. We know that in the limit when the roots are very big, it's given by this. How to prove it, we have no idea. But we use this physical intuition, and it is true. Now, I said that at strong coupling, we could do the same. So let me move to strong coupling. And this will be straightforward. Things at strong coupling are simpler. At strong coupling, however, here, you saw that at the end, I decided to take this limit. But from the expressions, I could take whatever I wanted. At strong coupling, there is, at the moment, a technical difficulty, and people cannot do whatever they want for three-point functions. They can do one heavy guy and then a couple of light guys. So at strong coupling, the current technology allows us to do the following, which is the analog of what I just did now. At strong coupling, we can do a big string. This is the boundary of ADS. And then there is a light operator, which we integrate a boundary to bulk propagator over where it attaches. So the way you do is you have the big classical solution. You consider that this guy does not back react on the solution. And you integrate over the position of this field. So there is like tau, there is sigma, and you do an integral d tau d sigma. Okay? More precisely, what you do is, I think I wrote this integral at some point, you do that integral there. Can you see? So C123 is an integral d tau d sigma. Okay, let me come to that more a bit later. So let me just say, what's the idea to do this computation? How can you find this solution? Is it complicated? No, it's simple. Because you can use conformal symmetry. So you have first your solution that you want to study. Say some folded string, like the one we did before at weak coupling, in the middle of ADS. Okay, this doesn't look like this. Now you do some analytic continuation, and you map it to a solution that starts in the point here. Basically, you change tau to y tau, and therefore what was exponential becomes decaying, and it goes to the boundary. And then you have the folded string here. Then you do a conformal transformation to map this infinite point to some finite points, and you get the string that you wanted. And then you decorate it by a small guy, assuming that it doesn't change the big guy. But the background is already fixed. Then you add the small propagator. Okay? Good. So this was done in a sequence of papers. So these first steps were done by Yannick and collaborators. Then this one here by Zarembo, and then Arkady generalized. And I want to emphasize that this is very different, very, very different, from cases such as three classical operators, of course. And this we cannot do. But let me, by the way, make a side remark, that this is roughly the same as what we do when we compute the expectation value of the Wilson, the polygon Wilson loops, and so on. This problem is also very hard to solve, to find a minimal surface. But for example, with Amit, Juan, and Fernando, we compute the area of this surface for any shape of the polygon without knowing the shape. And that was using integrability, using cycles and so on. And this should be the solution here. We will not be able, I guess, to find that solution ever. But to compute the area without knowing the solution, I think, is doable. OK, good. So then what does this computation give? This computation gives what I wrote over there. Let me explain this notation. So what is this notation? So this is just roughly a boundary to bulk propagator. This U1 and U2 to some powers, this just comes from choosing the operator that we want to be light. This is just a spherical harmonic. Okay? And this U, they are embedding coordinates. So U dot U star equal to 1. So U is X1 plus IX2, etc. It's coordinates of the 5-sphere. They square to 1. Okay? And this is the prescription. You do some boundary to bulk propagator, and you integrate, and you have this integral over the full world sheet as I represented there. Okay? Good. So now, what is this limit? Now, what can we do? Now, the simplest, naively, these prescriptions, they look very different. In one, we integrate this insertion over the full worksheet. We integrate over where we put it in the full worksheet. In the other one, it's like it's at a given time we compute the overlap. Right? Here, we just freeze in time, compute the overlap, and this gives us a number. So how come that computation gives the sum the same as this computation? Okay. Now, so what are these solutions U? So the simplest classical solution is just U, which is just an exponential, times a constant vector U naught. So this is just a solution which rotates around one of the circles of S5. And this guy tells you which circle, which BPS operator it is, the point-like string going around. And then the next to the simplest are operators, and these are the interesting operators, which are of the form, like small deformations from this one, where here you have a field which is not constant, but changes in a much smaller scale. Okay? Like you have some center of mass motion, which is very fast, and then you open a bit and you add some dynamics which are much slower than the center of mass motion, which is very fast. Now, this is equivalent, considering this limit is equivalent, this was shown by Kruszewski and then clarified in some papers by Arkady, to considering the limit where lambda goes to infinity, j goes to infinity, the charge is very large, but lambda over j square is much smaller than 1. Now, this is a cool limit, because, for example, because if you expand in this quantity, a strong coupling result, it might look like it is a weak coupling expansion. For example, the energy is equal to j, which is the value for the BMN string. It's just energy equal to the spin of the particle, plus lambda over 2j square integral d sigma u dot d sigma u bar. Okay? And now you go to these coherent states that we have here, or that we had somewhere, to these coherent states, compute the average of the Hamiltonian of the spin chain in this coherent state, and see what you get, and you get exactly this. So for any coherent state of the spin chain, and for any solution of the string in the Landau-Lifshitz, you get a match for the spectrum. Okay? Now, from a modern point of view, we know this is, roughly it's luck. And because this is not the same as lambda very small, it did not need to work. It doesn't work for theories with less supersymmetry like ABJM, but here it works, so why not? We use it as an inspiration. Now, this is the key fact. The fact that to get a match with weak coupling, we consider solutions with a very fast center of mass and then some very slow motion. Because this motion is very slow, when we are integrating over the worksheet, this dynamics is effectively frozen at tau equal to 0. So when we are doing the integral here over tau, you see you have here 1 over cos to the power kappa tau. Kappa is going to infinity. Kappa is very large. It's the energy of the string. And this is localizing the integral at tau equal to 0. So what we do is u, we can replace it by u, which was a function of sigma and tau, we can replace by u of sigma and tau equal to 0. Then we can do the integral trivially over tau, and we are left with the integral over sigma, and then this is precisely what we had at weak coupling. Okay, we get just exactly the same integral. The integral over tau we do, this becomes u1, u2, it's exactly what I wrote here. Yes? In the Landau-Lifshitz, in this Frolov-Seitlin limit for the spectrum? Yeah, that's what I was saying. So for the spectrum, the match was here. So you add that the energy was equal to the energy of the BMN string plus a small fluctuation, right? This was what I think you studied with Arkady and or with Matthias. And there was this correction, lambda over j square, right? And this is a strong coupling computation, but this is exactly the energy at weak coupling. It's exactly the same kind of match there. Two loops, yeah. So at 3 loops, it failed, yeah. So. Right. Exactly the same thing, yeah. So it works for the first loops. Why? Because of supersymmetry. And otherwise, there is a priori no deep reason. For example, in ABJM, doesn't work at all. It doesn't even work at 1 loop. But But the point is that, but here we know that there is some supersymmetry involved, it works, and we rather use this as a guide, more than to take this extremely seriously. So what we achieved was to have a common language. We understand that at strong coupling, the mechanism is that we have this computation, but effectively the dynamics are frozen at the slice tau Euclidean equal to zero. By the way, this is the only physical slice, because tau equal to zero is shared between Lorentzian and Euclidean. So it's like we are being obliged to take a picture of the string exactly in the point where you could rotate to Lorentzian and get the usual dynamics. So we are being told, take a photo at this point. Take the photo in the Lorentzian point. This is the feature of the leading term. So what would happen as you go away? Now, as you go away, you would have correction, which start to probe this curvature. What would happen from weak coupling? From weak coupling, as I was saying, you have these kind of terms, and you have to correct the wave functions. Do they still match? Can we still map these two types of contribution, curvature of the string with these extra decorations and correction? We don't know. We didn't study yet. And there are other limits that we can take. For example, from this monster, we got a number. We could get the next correction, the 1 over j correction, finite size correction. From string, this should be obtained from a one-loop string computation, like it was for the spectrum problem. So there are lots of interplay that we can start opening, and the point is that we have this unified language for studying both. And let me just say that from the weak coupling point of view, we could do some of these cases here, that for now are not yet, people cannot do it yet at strong coupling. So we have predictions, again in this Frolov cycling limit, for what the behavior at weak coupling is for when you have these big classical states. And there we did manage to attack the monster and kill it in some simplified limits. Thank you.